We had to end the last episode on a bit of a cliffhanger. The Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V, had already declared Martin Luther public enemy number one, but it would have been political suicide for him to press the point. You see, large portions of Germany had risen behind Luther and the growing reform movement that he had sparked. Still, Charles had to do something. Having dealt with the various military threats from France and the Ottoman Empire, he was finally ready to turn his attention back to that Lutheran problem. In a brief review of how we ended last time, in 1529, the Imperial Diet met at Speyer with a clear agenda. It was to reverse the religious toleration that had allowed Lutheran territories to flourish and restore Catholic uniformity throughout the Holy Roman Empire. Now, the Diet's decisions were devastating for Protestant territories. The previous Diet of Speyer in 1526, that had allowed each prince to determine religious policy in his own territory, effectively legalizing Lutheranism where local rulers supported it. But the 1529 Diet revoked that tolerance. The new mandate required all Lutheran territories to return to Catholic practices immediately. No further innovations in worship or doctrine would be permitted. Lutheran pastors would be expelled, Lutheran books burned, and traditional Catholic services restored. Now, for Protestant princes like Frederick the Wise's successor, John the Steadfast, and Philip of Hesse, this meant choosing between their religious convictions and their political survival. Their response was historic. On April 19th of 1529, six princes and 14 imperial cities signed a formal protest against the Diet's decisions. They argued that matters of conscience could not be decided by majority vote, and that they owed obedience to God before they owed obedience to the emperor. This protest gave the Protestant movement its name. The signers became known as Protestants, that is, those who protested against what they saw as an illegitimate attempt to coerce religious belief. But more than a name was at stake. The protest essentially declared that Protestant territories would resist imperial religious policy by force if necessary. The stage was set for armed conflict between Protestant and Catholic forces within the Holy Roman Empire. The emperor responded to the Protestant protest by calling for a new diet to meet at Augsburg in 1530. And this would be the Protestant movement's day of judgment. Charles would give them one final opportunity to explain their position and return to Catholic unity or face the full weight of imperial power. The summons to Augsburg put enormous pressure on Protestant leaders. They would need to present their case before the emperor himself, defending their theological positions while avoiding language that would make compromise impossible. Luther wanted to attend the Diet personally, but that was impossible. He was still under the imperial ban from the Edict of Worms, meaning that he could be arrested or killed on sight in imperial territory. He would have to remain in Saxony while others defended the movement he had started. Now, the task of preparing for Augsburg fell primarily to Philip Melanchthon. His diplomatic temperament and careful scholarship made him, well, really the ideal person to craft a defense that was both theologically sound and politically prudent. Melanchthon began working on what would become the Augsburg Confession in early 1530. His goal was to demonstrate that Lutheran theology was not a dangerous innovation, but really a return to biblical and early church teaching. He wanted to show that Lutherans were not rebels against legitimate authority, but faithful Christians seeking to restore authentic Christianity. Now, the challenge, you can imagine, was enormous. How do you defend a movement that had rejected papal authority, eliminated most traditional sacraments, allowed clerical marriage, and fundamentally redefined salvation, while still claiming to be within the bounds of legitimate Christianity? Melanchthon's approach to the Augsburg Confession was brilliantly strategic. Instead of focusing on what Lutherans rejected about Catholicism, he emphasized what they affirmed about Christianity. Instead of attacking Catholic errors, he demonstrated Lutheran orthodoxy. Now, the confession was structured in two main parts. The first part, containing 21 articles, that laid out core Lutheran beliefs on fundamental Christian doctrines. The Trinity, Christ's divine and human nature, justification by faith, the nature of the church, baptism, the Lord's Supper. Melanchthon was careful to show that on most basic Christian doctrines, Lutherans agreed completely with Catholic teaching. The confession affirmed traditional Christian beliefs about God, Christ, salvation, demonstrating that Lutheranism wasn't a departure from Christianity. It was a reform within it, really something that others had tried to do over the years. Where Lutheran teaching differed from Catholic practice, Melanchthon presented these differences as corrections of medieval corruptions rather than innovations. For example, on justification by faith, the confession argued that this was the clear teaching of Scripture and the early church fathers. It was not some new Lutheran invention. The second part of the confession addressed specific abuses that Lutherans had corrected, requiring celibacy of priests, withholding the cup from lay people in communion, the sacrifice of the Mass, mandatory confession, and the sale of indulgences. Now again, Melanchthon's strategy was to show that Lutheran reforms were necessary corrections of non-biblical practices. They were not rebellious attacks on legitimate church authority. While Melanchthon worked on the confession, Luther was essentially under house arrest at Coburg Castle, just inside Saxon territory, but close enough to Augsburg that he could provide advice and consultation. There was a constant stream of messengers back and forth. Now, the correspondence between Luther and Melanchthon during this period reveals both the strengths and the tensions in their relationship. Luther repeatedly urged Melanchthon to be bolder and less conciliatory towards Catholic opponents. He feared that his diplomatic colleague might compromise essential truths in the interest of political peace. Luther wrote to Melanchthon, quote, "I am thoroughly displeased that you are worried about what the issue of this cause will be. You are worried about matters that are beyond your strength and ability. If the cause is false, let us recant. If it is true, why do we make God a liar by our anxious cares?" Unquote. Now, Melanchthon, meanwhile, he was trying to navigate the impossible task of satisfying both Luther's theological convictions and the political realities of the Diet. He wanted to be faithful to Lutheran principles while leaving room for possible reconciliation with Catholic authorities. You know, this tension between theological purity and political pragmatism, that would define much of the relationship between Luther and Melanchthon throughout their partnership. Luther was the prophetic voice calling for uncompromising faithfulness to biblical truth. Melanchthon, he was the diplomatic bridge builder, seeking ways to maintain that faithfulness while avoiding unnecessary conflict. On June 25th of 1530, the Augsburg Confession was read aloud before Emperor Charles V and the assembled Diet. The reading took 2 hours. It was delivered in both German and Latin to ensure that everyone present could understand. Now listen, this moment was historic. For the first time, a Protestant church was formally presenting its belief to the highest political authority in Europe. The Lutheran movement was no longer an informal protest. It was an organized church with clear doctrinal standards. Emperor Charles' response was measured but ominous. He acknowledged that the confession had been respectfully presented and promised to have it carefully studied by Catholic theologians, but his tone? Now that suggested that he was not impressed by Lutheran arguments for reform. The Catholic response came in the form of what was called, quote, "confutation of the Augsburg Confession," unquote, which rejected most Lutheran positions and demanded complete submission to papal authority. The confutation essentially argued that the Lutherans had been listened to respectfully but found wanting. Emperor Charles then demanded that Protestant territories return to Catholic unity by April 15th of 1531 or face military action. The religious and political crisis that Luther had triggered with the 95 Theses, it was now coming to a head. Although the Augsburg Confession failed to achieve reconciliation with Catholic authorities, it succeeded in accomplishing something far more important. It gave the Lutheran movement a clear, authoritative statement of faith that would guide Protestant churches for centuries. The confession became the foundational document of Lutheran Christianity, defining what it meant to be Lutheran in clear, systematic terms. It demonstrated that Protestantism, it was not just a negative reaction against Catholicism, but a positive affirmation of biblical Christianity. Perhaps most importantly, the confession showed that the Protestant movement had matured from revolution to institution. Luther's passionate protests had been transformed into careful theological reflections. The movement now had the intellectual infrastructure necessary for long-term survival and growth. The political failure at Augsburg led Protestant territories to form what was called the Schmalkaldic League, a military alliance for mutual defense against Catholic forces. The religious controversy that Luther had started was now becoming an armed conflict that would reshape European politics for generations. The period from the Peasants' War to the Augsburg Confession revealed both the strengths and the limitations of the Luther-Melanchthon partnership. Luther provided the prophetic passion and theological conviction that gave the movement its driving force. Melanchthon provided the scholarly precision and diplomatic skill that gave it intellectual respectability and political viability. But their different temperaments also created ongoing tension. Luther accused Melanchthon of being too willing to compromise with error for the sake of peace. Melanchthon found Luther's uncompromising positions unnecessarily divisive and politically dangerous. The Marburg Colloquy illustrated this tension perfectly. Luther's refusal to find common ground with Zwingli reflected his conviction that theological truth was more important than political unity. Melanchthon shared Luther's theological position, but regretted the political consequences of their inability to compromise. Despite these tensions, the partnership was extraordinarily fruitful. Luther's passionate commitment to biblical truth, combined with Melanchthon's careful scholarship, produced a theological movement that was both spiritually powerful and intellectually rigorous. By 1530, Martin Luther had successfully navigated the transition from revolutionary critic to institutional builder. The movement that began with questions about indulgences had become, a comprehensive alternative to medieval Catholicism, complete with a systematic theology, organized churches, and political protection. The Augsburg Confession, it really represented the culmination of this institutional development. What had started as just one monk's protest against church corruption had become a mature religious movement with clear doctrinal standards and broad popular support. But the confession also revealed the limitations of theological diplomacy. Despite Melanchthon's careful, respectful presentation, Catholic authorities, they were unwilling to accept any significant Protestant reforms. The hope for reconciliation through dialogue failed, making armed conflict inevitable. Luther's partnership with Melanchthon showed how complementary gifts could strengthen a movement. The passionate reformer and the careful scholar, they needed each other to accomplish what neither could have achieved alone. But the failure to achieve unity with Zwingli at Marburg demonstrated that even shared commitment to biblical authority could not prevent theological disagreements. The Protestant movement would continue to fragment along doctrinal lines, showing the principle of sola scriptura did not automatically produce an interpretive consensus. As Luther approached the final phase of his career, he could look back with satisfaction on what had been accomplished. The gospel of justification by faith alone had been clearly articulated and widely accepted. Churches had been reformed according to biblical principles. The Bible, it had been translated into German, making God's word accessible to ordinary believers and not just the domain of ordained clergy. But challenges remained. Political pressures were mounting towards armed conflict. Theological disagreements were fragmenting Protestant unity. The institutional church that Luther was building would need to survive without its founding father. The monk who had nailed 95 questions to a church door, he had become the leader of an international religious movement. The anxious friar, who worried that he could never do enough to please God, had helped millions discover that salvation was a gift, was not an achievement. But most importantly, the passionate reformer, he had successfully passed his work to capable successors like Melanchthon, who could continue building on the foundation that he had laid. The Reformation would outlive its founder because it had been transformed from one man's protest into a sustainable institutional movement. The Augsburg Confession stands as a monument to that transformation, a document that captured Luther's theological insights in Melanchthon's diplomatic language, creating a bridge between the passion of revolution and the stability of institution.